Thank you, Terry. We do have some time for questions, comments. Larry Hart.
Larry Hart, American Conservative Union. For Tom and or Dr. Adu, unfortunately, my view is that we are headed into a period when the Chris Dodds and the Bill Delahunts, the pro-Chavez, pro-Morales, pro-Ortega crowd will have the dominant influence on our policy. But for the sake of argument and for those of us who will be trying to come up with alternative policies to promote freedom and the free market in Latin America, what should be the United States policy to effectively promote freedom in Latin America without falling into the trap that Dr. Adu mentioned of a Morales or a Chavez being able to say this is the export of imperialist capitalism, which is an easy argument to make.
Dr. Radu, would you like to go first, and then I'll comment?
You'll go first.
Okay. I think one of the things that, we have to do, I've been very impressed with, some of our speakers who were here from Latin America, and that sort of grounding, that principled intellectual grounding that they and others represent, and the willingness of people in the private sector to establish both secular as well as religious-oriented institutions in Guatemala, for example. I mean, I date back when I went there in 1970 with the White House Fellowship Program. I was very impressed with one of the universities there. The recognition that you have to overcome that, every time I've been in Latin America, the state institutions, similar to what we have here, seem to turn out leftists, and there seems to be a growing recognition of the importance of providing a foundation, an intellectual conservative foundation, and my hat's off to those people who are involved, and we can encourage that. There are a lot of ways. The point I was trying to make, we won the Cold War with hardly a shot being fired in terms of our own military forces, but we supported the local leaders in the private sector and the government forces and others who were committed to making a difference. I was with, for example, Ambassador Frank Shakespeare, who spoke in Dallas to a group about a year ago. People don't realize how closely he worked with Bill Casey and on behalf of the president with folks in the Vatican dealing with this liberation theology problem, which is still out there. So there are a lot of things we can do without being the big, ugly American. And, I just don't know. I mean, clearly it's going to be awful if Obama gets there, but I don't know who is going to be, John McCain's representative in terms of Latin American affairs. I think Roger Fontaine, those of you who may know Roger, I thought did a fine job in the Reagan administration when I was there, and Bill Clark, and Casey and Weinberg. So I think it's a leader who recognizes the importance of Latin America, and I'm not sure that the current group of leaders understands it. And secondly, it's not by military force, but it's supporting those forces, and maybe, where's our CIA when we need it? I mean, President Eisenhower was very effective in that regard, and the Reagan administration was very effective in that regard, and the Nixon administration to a degree. So those are my thoughts. Dr. Radu?
Well, we have a long way to go because we have fallen so low. Let me give you an example of things that are basic, so basic that politicians fail to understand. Recently, after Morales threw out the U.S. ambassador, and it became clear that he sees himself and behaves first as the trade union boss of the Cocaleros, and then as president of Bolivia. Therefore, cooperation with U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency and so on went down. Finally, Washington woke up for a moment, and the president threatened to cancel the tariff advantages Bolivia has under the Andean trade arrangements. And that would have resulted, or so depending on whom you ask, that would have resulted or would result in between 80 and 150,000 jobs lost. And not only that, but most importantly, because we are talking here about textiles and jewelry and some leather goods, most of those jobs would be in La Paz and in El Alto, which is a kind of twin of La Paz, with mostly Indian population. In other words, most of those jobs lost would affect Morales' base of popular support, first of all. In other words, we have to reteach people that while they have a right to hate the United States, that right also implies costs. So first, turning the other cheek is never the solution. That's why I'm afraid that an Obama administration will do just that, just like the Carter administration did, turn the other cheek and blame Bush, of course, and just about everybody in the history of the United States for whatever Chavez, Morales, Correa, and so on do. We are being told, and that's legal, we cannot complain, that we have to leave the Manta base in Ecuador, which is strictly used for drug control operations over the Pacific, doesn't have much to do with Ecuador other than being there. Well, Ecuadorians say that we have to leave, and the arrangement says that by 2009 they have the right to ask that, so we are leaving. But what is the price for them? We are not imposing any price. We can hit Ecuador too. And to see how bad this whole thing is and how it's not just limited to the United States, you have people in Washington and even more of them in Europe talking about this interesting idea of President Correa, which is like this. You, the West, Europeans and the United States, pay Ecuador something like $280, if I'm not mistaken, $1 million a year, so that we do not exploit our oil in a certain natural reserve. In other words, Ecuador gets more than $200 million in subsidies for not producing oil at a time when everybody needs more oil. Now, you may say that's inane. It isn't. That's why he's proposing that, because he knows it may work. And there are already three countries in Europe who are interested, Norway, which could afford it because they sit on oil, Sweden, and another one, I don't remember. So is this kind of much more serious problem than just lack of attention? What conservatives can do, other than noise, for the next administration, the way I see it, is preparing their colleagues in Latin America, because one of the main reasons people like Chavez, Correa, and company came to power and stay in power is, as I mentioned, the ineptness of the opposition, which doesn't know the basic ways of dealing with a regime like that. And of course, they are themselves scared of anti-Americanists, and they don't want to be associated with Americans, so that they, in a way, accept the regime's claims. And that will take a lot of work, and probably has to be done by the private sector. Not the business sector, don't raise your hopes, but some private entities.
Before I ask the next person to comment, your point so well taken about economic pressure, that was such a key factor in the Reagan strategy to win the Cold War, and we tend to forget that part of it, and it could be very, very helpful here in this situation. Yes, sir.
Jim Roberts from the Heritage Foundation. I've been doing a lot of thinking and writing about the potential positive impacts of reforms on both sides of the border, U.S. and Mexico. For example, people have talked about the problem of the Mexican economy, and so much of it is roped off by statist policies, energy, electricity, electricity transmission, and you name it. And what isn't roped off directly as belonging to the government is roped off by monopolies and duopolies and a corporatist sweetheart and a good old boy network. And then in this country, people have noted the problems with the cost to the taxpayers of illegal immigrants, and if they were legalized and paying taxes and the employers are paying taxes, the wages would be higher and the tax revenues would be higher, and then when we could afford to give them education and health care. So I just wondered if anybody had any thoughts on that on the panel, and whether you know of any research that's been done along those lines. Thanks.
Dr. Hallmark?
Well, I don't have any comment specifically to your questions, but you know, I've been doing a bit of work over the years about whether or not Mexico may open up. You know, a big issue that I deal with is whether they're going to open up the oil industry. And I find them to be exceedingly xenophobic about the whole thing. And it's interesting. A friend of mine said, because I don't understand it. The industry doesn't understand it. It seems like there could be some real advances there for the good of both sides of the border. But as a friend of mine said, he's you know, when you think about the monopolies and duopolies and the things you mentioned, you know, he said, when it comes to energy, he says, you reckon at some point that that Mexico is going to run completely out of energy, you know, because they're going to be so hard-headed about it. And out there, out in the desert someplace will be a guy with a hand-cranked, you know, phonograph, you know, because there is no electricity, playing Frank Sinatra's "We Did It Our Way," you know. And so and so I'm just baffled every time I try to research the subject, and I've been asked by governmental agencies and corporations and legal firms going back to at least as far as 1986, where they anticipated a change in the Mexican Constitution that would open all this up, and I just kind of go, I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that, to tie it into that, it would, my assumption is that it would create hundreds of thousands of jobs in Mexico.
Oh,
and diminish the pressure for the out-migration to the north.
No, well, we are in Texas, so I'm not going to talk too much about oil because there are too many people who know more than I do here. The fact is that Mexico will probably cease production of oil in the next decade if things continue the way they are. And their problems are that they don't have the technology or the money to even import the technology if that technology is available. And here is the problem. Right now, if you want to buy or rent a rig, you probably have to wait 10 years. Mm-hmm. So if Mexico starts tomorrow morning, either by privatizing Pemex or inviting the big company, the oil companies, it won't see any result in terms of growing production because the oil is there. For 10 years, if they start today. So if you are interested in immigration, if when Mexico was a major oil producer, we had millions of Mexicans coming to this country, imagine what would happen when Mexico would be probably a net importer of oil. They are already importing half of their gasoline from us. There is also a psychological problem. In Mexico, if there is something which is universally shared, with a few exception, a few American non-Harvard educated technocrats, is that, first of all, oil is a national thing, you never alienate it. And until they see that they don't have any, they will not change that. The second assumption, which is encouraged by politicians in this country also, is that Mexicans have a God-given right to export their unemployed north of the Rio Grande. That has to be changed again. It's not the responsibility of the United States to take care of the Mexican unemployed. It's the responsibility of the Mexican government. But you don't hear that very often in Washington, do you?
Barbara Elliott.
Just address the question having to do with those who are working here. The people who are looking at this issue as contractors, particularly in the construction industry, have pointed out that the disparity, the difficulty right now is for those who utilize primarily immigrants as independent contractors. Whether they're legal or illegal here, as long as they are being categorized as independent contractors, those employers are not paying the portion of Social Security that would be required if they were otherwise employed, nor are the employees themselves. However, for those who are simply operating under a Social Security number that they may have gotten at a flea market someplace, they are actually paying Social Security, which is kind of an interesting anomaly. It's a fairly substantial amount, too. In 2002, the Social Security Administration received about $56 billion in payments for numbers that do not exist in the name of that person. So they are creating a Social Security payment system, although they will never reap any of the benefits. Kind of an interesting quirk. But the real difficulty right now for employers who would like to hire employees legally is that there is no valid and reliable national system for checking Social Security numbers. There's an attempt, but right now, if you make a false accusation and it turns out that person actually does have a card, you're liable for lawsuits. So they're erring on the side of generosity. So until that's fixed, it can't really be helped. But those who are independent contractors right now are working they are working sometimes 60 hours a week without overtime. The employers are not offering them workman's compensation, and the honest employers, like the Stan Merricks of the world, who we both know, are actually being jeopardized and penalized for their observing the law and treating their employees fairly.
Professor Grogley.
Ms. Elliott, what you're doing is marvelous, commendable in every way, but you have to wonder, do you not, whether everyone can graduate high school, whether that is a realistic or even a desirable objective. You're familiar with Charles Murray's recent book on education. Now, there's a clear-eyed, hard-headed observer, and he argues that for most people now, it's not valuable to go to college. And, you know, not everybody is cut out for algebra, if that's part of it. So unless the idea of what a high school education is very much revised, and clearly, vocational is the idea. As he points out, it's harder to get an electrician than a doctor.
Well, that's the way we're going. Governor Perry's really emphasized that. That's what we're doing at the Workforce Commission. And to follow up on the point of those who graduate from high school in the bottom 40% of their class, go on to a four-year college as their first institution. 8.5 years later, two-thirds of them have not graduated, but I'm sure they and their families have huge debt that has been accumulated. So your point's well taken. I think there's a move in that direction that this idea everybody has to go to college makes no sense.
Ms. Elliott, that was it. Everybody's going to go to high school.
Well, high school is one thing.
There's
I mean,
a
you got to have the basics. I mean, you know, whether if you're going to be a good electrician or welder or pipe fitter, you know, the basics are very helpful and very important there. But I don't think that's what she was intending.
Let me just jump in. I'll concur. I'm not saying they should all go to college. That would actually be diluting the intention of what a genuine liberal arts education ought to be. But I do think the minimum requirement to master the English language and have some rudimentary understanding of the history of the nation, to at least been exposed to the literature, will make them better citizens and contribute something to the economy. I do believe that then learning a trade is absolutely the way to go. We have a need for plumbers, electricians, carpenters. There's a crying need for them. We're short of nurses, a whole variety of things where the next stage of education should be specific to that trade. That's important, and that's what I'm advocating, but I am suggesting that we have simply written them off as useless and incapable of learning, and that's not true for all of them.
Jeff Gaynor.
Jeff Gaynor with the Council for America in Washington. As you probably know, there's something called the Security for Prosperity and Partnership between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And in sort of the policy wonk circles in Washington, there's been discussion that this may eventually lead into a North American Union, just as the European Economic Community eventually has led to the European Union. What does the members of the panel think of prospective policy discussions in this area of the NAFTA agreement eventually leading to a North American Union as a way to ultimately solve the problems, especially bilateral problems?
I'm going to make a short comment. I think what's going on now in the international financial system is the best argument against this whole notion of global democracy and all linked together and end of nationalism and end of nations. So I'm very much opposed to the direction some people are pushing in that regard. Terry Hallmark. Terry,
I would also suggest to those who entertain such ideas to study a bit the experience of the European Union and to see how the very progressive, very tolerant, and all those good things, Swedes or Dutch, were so reluctant, still are reluctant, to accept Romanian or Bulgarian workers, and that's within the European Union when they have an obligation to do so sooner or later. So if the idea of having 110 million Mexicans moving to Illinois, because it's unlikely that you'll have Illinoisans moving to Oaxaca, if that's something that anybody thinks would gain votes in this country, well, let them try.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. See you all a little later.
Oh. Bill, do you have a...